The people of the book are not necessarily the people of the story. What's true of the Irish, of the Hungarians, of certain Native American tribes, was not true of the Jews. Until very recently, no professional class of storytellers existed within Jewish society. Yes, yes, I know there were occasions for narrative performance, and you could find them anywhere in the calendar of traditional Jewish life. It wasn't all work and no play. Little boys who studied in Cheder used to hear stories from their teacher, their Rebbe, as a reward for proper religious behavior. And when at play, the same children swapped ghost stories among themselves. The few boys who graduated, let's say, to independent Talmud study in the Bes Medrash, in the House of Study, were rewarded with an occasional ma'aseh beh, a story concerning such and such a rabbi, or his wife, or his donkey, which appeared in the densely printed pages of the Talmudic folio. Those who studied on their own, grown-ups, adult men who hung out in the House of Study, would huddle behind the stove between late afternoon and evening prayers, just enough time to swap a tall tale or two. And those stories were called Mises Hintern Oven, stories that were told behind the stove. And Chassidim in their house of prayer, in their shtiebel, would tell miracle tales about their favorite Rebbe or Tzaddik or wonder worker at specific moments in the Hasidic calendar. If you went to synagogue from time to time, you would hear a wandering preacher, a magid, deliver a sermon. And these sermons would be punctuated with a story or two. But they were fairly predictable, and they were very preachy, very didactic. Women stood at the back or listened from upstairs. So from all of this, we can learn that even telling sacred tales, was pretty much limited. And as for the performance of non-sacred tales, well, these were reserved for the margins of society, for children and beggars. This, then, is the story of the modern Jewish return to a world of pure fantasy, to the spoken language, to the joys of Yiddish, to storytelling as an autonomous, compelling, highly creative, potentially explosive activity. Our guides will be three of the most outstanding practitioners of the lost and found art of Yiddish storytelling: Reb Nachman ben Simcha of Braslav, I.L. Peretz, and Isaac Bashevis Singer. We're going to take them one at a time, nice and easy. What is it that we should be listening for? The first thing is the what and the how of the story. We're going to be looking at the ancient craft of twice-told tales, or what you could call the ecology of storytelling, how stories are recycled. A seasoned storyteller will not make up the material out of whole cloth, but will reuse pre-existing plots. So what we're listening for is how the story, as retold, deviates from the story as we know it from before. So that's the first thing. The second is the who. Who's narrating this story? Who's speaking within the story? And what can be said through live storytelling that can't be said any other way? So let's go. And we'll start with an archetypal plot, a story which we might as well call The Abducted Princess. So it's a story about a princess who was abducted from the royal palace by some evil supernatural power. A brave young man, usually he's a noble, but not necessarily noble by birth, volunteers to set her free after lengthy trials and tribulations. after near-death encounters. He liberates her from the powers of evil. He returns her to the palace and marries the princess. Those are the bare bones of the plot, and we'll call that the abducted princess. Okay. So, the date is the 25th of July, 1806. And a group of Hasidim, followers of Reb Nachman Breslover, are taking a stroll on that Shabbos afternoon. They're taking a walk in nature, and he's talking to his very small group of disciples because he didn't have very many disciples. Because it's Shabbos, it's a kind of semi-sacred act, and it also means that they can't write anything down. So all they can do is listen. And they've never heard him tell a story before. So he starts telling them a story, which in English would sound like this. Once there was a king. The king had six sons and one daughter. The daughter was extremely important to him, and he cherished her and enjoyed her company very much. Once on a certain day when he was with her, he became enraged at her, and from his mouth slipped the sentence, "May the not good take you away." That night, she went to her room, and in the morning, no one knew where she was. Her father, the king, grieved deeply, and he sent here and there searching for her. Then the viceroy, seeing that the king was deeply grieved, rose and requested that a servant, a horse, and money for expenses be given to him. And he set out to search for her, and he searched for her for a very long time until he found her. And now the editor says, Reb Nachman tells how he searched for her until he found her. So the initial situation is a king who had six sons and a single daughter. And he loved that daughter very much. But for no apparent reason, he curses her in anger and he says, "Go to the devil." In Yiddish, "Der nit guter soll dich nehmen." May the devil take you. And then the next thing we know, she disappears. The viceroy sets out to find her, and he searches for her in vain for several years until he finally finds her. And now the story begins again, and we find out more or less how that happened. And so he goes and wanders for a very long time until he comes upon a castle guarded by many soldiers. Even though it's guarded by many soldiers, he enters unhindered. He makes his way to the king's hall, and he sees that there is some celebration about to begin. And with great fanfare, in a moment or two, as he is hiding in a corner, he sees the queen is ushered into the royal ballroom. And who should that queen be, if not the abducted princess? The princess looks around and espies him hiding in the corner, and when the king is not watching, comes over to him and says, "Here I am, and this, the curse that my father cursed me, came true. This is the devil's abode. You have found me in the devil's abode. So, how can you liberate me from here?" says she. "Choose a solitary spot. Yearn for me a whole long year. Think about me all that year. And on the very last day, you must not eat or sleep. It's very important to remember, on that last day, don't eat or sleep. And if you manage to make it through that year-long cycle, you will liberate me from this." Well, we know what's going to happen. He does hold out for 364 days of that year, and he thinks and longs about her. But on that crucial last day, he will fail the test. He succumbs to his passion for food. He eats an apple off a tree and falls asleep. And he sleeps and sleeps and sleeps for many years. When he wakes up, he asks his servant, "Wie bin ich in der Welt? Where in the world am I? What has happened?" And the servant tells him, "You ate of the apple, you fell asleep, and that's that." He's, of course, very distraught, and he goes back to the very same castle. And the story is repeated. He meets up with the princess, who grieves greatly over his failure, and says, "Well, I know this was very difficult, not to eat or drink Not to eat a whole on that last day is very difficult. Here's what you should do. Long for me, think about me all year long, and on that last day, remember, don't sleep, don't drink any wine. And if you manage to persevere, you will free me. He lasts 364 days of the year, but on that very last day, he passes a spring, and he's dying of thirst, and decides to drink of its red waters, and falls asleep for 70 years. This time, while he is asleep, the princess passes him by with her royal retinue and espies him asleep next to the highway. She weeps over him, weeps over his failure to have rescued him. Then she leaves him a handkerchief inscribed with her tears. When he wakes up, he asks his servant, "Wie bin ich in der Welt? Where am I?" And the servant says, "You drank of the red waters, you fell asleep. But while you were asleep, the princess happened by. And this is what she left. She left you her kerchief, her handkerchief, inscribed with her tears." He holds up the message, the handkerchief to the sun, and reads the encoded message. She says, "Now I am no longer in that castle where you first found me. I am imprisoned on a golden mountain in a pearly castle. You go and find me there." So the third part of the story is the viceroy's repeated attempts to find her on this golden mountain in a pearly castle. And since this is a traditional folktale, everything that is repeated will be repeated three times. So he wanders and wanders for years and years and years. And one day he comes upon a giant, a huge individual carrying a large tree. And he says to this giant, "Who are you?" And the giant says, "I am a person." He says, "And not only that, but I am a person who is in charge of all the animals." And so the viceroy says, "If you are in charge of the animals, perhaps you can tell me. I'm looking for a golden mountain and a pearly castle." The giant says, "There is no such place. Forget about it." The viceroy weeps bitterly and says, "No, I know there must be." Says the giant, "Look, I am in charge of all the animals. And they don't know anything about this. But I have a brother who is in charge of all the birds. Let me call upon him, and we'll ask him." And so they bring the second giant, and the viceroy repeats his plea. "I'm looking for a pearly castle on a golden mountain." Says the second giant, "No, forget about it. There is no such place." The viceroy weeps and weeps and says, "It cannot be, it cannot be. There must be such a place." So the third giant says, "Look, you know what? You keep going, and there's one more brother who is the giant in charge of all the winds." And so the giant in charge of all the winds appears, and the same thing is repeated. The viceroy says, "I'm looking for a pearly castle on a golden mountain." Says the giant, "There is no such place." At which point, the viceroy is crying so bitterly, in the very midst of his tears, a wind appears who is late. Why is he late? Because he has just transported a princess onto a pearly castle on a golden mountain. Well, in that case, he has found the right direction. That third giant gives the viceroy the necessary information and a magic purse. So the viceroy sets out for the third time to find her in the castle. This time, he needs to bribe his way in. He finds room and board in the home of some wealthy man. And then he rescues the princess. But precisely how he rescues the princess is never explained. End of story. So, what kind of story is this? Obviously, it's a fairy tale. And the editor of these stories quotes Reb Nachman as saying, these are ma'asiyot she'ha'olam misaper. These are well-known folktales. I didn't really make up the plot. I took a pre-existing plot. These are stories that you can hear other people tell. And it's a familiar landscape of palaces and castles and deserts, and it's timeless and yet somehow medieval. Time lasts for years upon years, but what's really important are the telescope moments, those fateful encounters. The hero is the viceroy, but all the relationships are fairly formulaic, as they are in fairy tales. The style is extremely repetitive. Everything that happens happens three times. It's full of stock phrases. There are abrupt changes in scenery. And the plot is very single-stranded. He must fulfill the task, and the story won't be over until he successfully fulfills that task. All the magical elements in the story are the demons, the changes of scenery. Well, miracles are everywhere. They are the warp and woof of the fairy tale, and so they don't even have to be explained. This is the first of 13 stories that Reb Nachman told and are memorialized in a book called Sipurei Maises, The Tales. And it's very much a signature tale because the others, like this one, are full of magic donors and talking birds and weird symbolism, and many, and if not most of the characters are nameless heroes and heroines, abducted princesses, banished princes, viceroys, pirates, lots of beggars, sea voyages. What's odd and interesting is there are, in these stories, very few Jewish markers. There is no Eliyahu Hanovi, no Elijah the prophet. There are no secret saints. Later on, there will be an occasional Baal Shem, a rabbi, a Murano, but mostly these are stories full of omens, warnings, interdictions, reversals of fortune, and most important, each story is a quest. Some of them end happily, and others don't end at all. So what's different here? In what sense has Reb Nachman taken the genre of the fairy tale and changed it, adapted it to his own purposes? First of all, there is the matter of the very abrupt ending. He actually gives the plot away at the very beginning, as we have heard. Where's the suspense if we already know how it will end? And yet, when we get to the end, the climax is missing. How precisely did he manage to extricate her from that pearly castle on top of the mountain? We don't know. Secondly, there are no acts of physical bravery. The viceroy doesn't have to kill any dragons or joust or do anything like that. He just cries a lot and longs for her. There is a lack of real action. What's more, there's no erotic element. He doesn't get to marry the princess. He just brings her back to her father. And that presumably is the end of the story. Moreover, he's oftentimes asleep himself. We have the Sleeping Beauty motif, but it's backwards. He's the one who's fallen asleep, not her. There are other features in this story which will reappear in others' stories by Reb Nachman. There are giants and guards. What is their task? These giants stand on the threshold, on the border of two worlds. They belong to the supernatural realm, and their task in the story is to convince the hero that the supernatural realm does not exist. Forget about it. There is no such castle. It doesn't exist. Go back. To rescue the princess, it's just a dream. It can never come true. But without those giants, the viceroy, the hero, has no access to the supernatural realm. So he has to pass through that border area in order to achieve his desired goal. The settings, the forests, the deserts, and the oceans, while they are fairly common for the folktale, what Reb Nachman always emphasizes is how far removed they are from cities and towns. Why is that so important? Because these are transitory places where the hero is alone, where the hero must confront his own weaknesses, where the quest is internalized. The process is complex, is arduous, and it has to do with overcoming his own inhibitions and his own shortcomings. The ending is less important, in fact, than the process itself. What all of this suggests is that these are not mere fairy tales. There is something else going on here, some symbolic framework, some hidden meaning. But what is it? What is it that we're missing? Before we can answer that, we also have to listen much more carefully to the way this story is told and who is narrating it and the very language. It is no accident that Reb Nachman of Breslov was the first bona fide Yiddish storyteller in Eastern European Jewish culture, because he grew out of the Hasidic movement. Hasidism was a mass movement based on oral performance. It represented a dramatic turn to orality from the very bookish, elitist, closed world of Kabbalists and learned Jewish society. Hasidism itself spread by means of magidim, preachers who spread the Hasidic gospel in synagogues and houses of study. Hasidism also spread through the scripted performance of the tzaddik himself, at his table, at a communal table, where each discourse of the Rebbe stood alone, and his teaching was perceived as a kind of revelation. Personal attendance at the tzaddik's live performance, reinforced by periodic interruptions of song, of nigunim, of drinking, these were the core experiences of being a Hasidic disciple. Nachman of Breslov's career represents a dramatic moment of outburst of orality, of the spoken language breaking out to the surface. That Shabbos afternoon in the summer of 1806, Reb Nachman of Breslov made history. By returning to fantasy, to live storytelling in a living language, Reb Nachman jump-started a revolution in Jewish culture and in Jewish consciousness. How did he do that precisely? Well, of all the genres of stories, he chose the Wundermeise, the fairy tale. That is a speech genre. Fairy tales circulated orally. Very few of them actually were ever written down because they weren't didactic. They didn't serve any overt religious purpose. And that's the kind of story that he chose quite deliberately. Stories that the whole world tells. They are not particular to Jewish culture. They are not embedded in sacred texts. They circulate freely in the world. And that's why he chose them. Having done that, he also appears as a storyteller in a living language. And the language here is Yiddish, modern Eastern Yiddish. Thanks to the Breslov Hasidim, we have an accurate transcript of the way Yiddish was spoken at the beginning of the 19th century, complete with all the local expressions. And we feel from the get-go that this is a living, spoken dialect. We feel the breathless rhythm of an unfolding story with the consecutive word order of a live storytelling, full of repetitions, circling back. Here is what it sounds like as the story progresses, picking up from where we left off. So first I'll read it to you in English so you'll get the gist of it. He traveled for a long time, here and there in deserts and fields and forests, and he searched for her for a very long time. While traveling in the desert, he saw a path off to the side and reflected, "Since I have been traveling such a long time in the desert and cannot find her, I shall follow this path. Maybe I will come to a settled place." And he traveled for a long time. At last he saw a castle with many soldiers posted around it. The castle was very beautiful, and the soldiers were standing around it in perfect order. And he feared that the soldiers would not let him in, but he reflected, "I shall attempt it." Okay. But here's what it sounds like in Yiddish. Is er gegangen a lange Zeit, und in Midborjes, und in Felder, und in Wälder, und hat sie gesucht, sehr a lange Zeit. Is er gegangen in Midbar, und in der Midbar, und kann sie nicht gefinnen. Lass mich gehen auf dem Weg. Tomer will ich kommen zu a Yeshiv. Is er gegangen a lange Zeit, der noch hat er gesehen a Schloss, und a sa Chayoles stehen herum. Und das Schloss ist gewesen sehr schön, und die Chayoles sind herumgestanden, geseder sehr fein. Hat er Mori gehabt für die Chayoles, Tomer wollen sie ihm nicht losen a reingehen. Hat er sich mit Yashiv gewesen, ich will mich proven. Und hat übergelost das Pferd und ist gegangen zu dem Schloss. So, he's going for a very long way, and he is speaking to himself. And each time he speaks to himself, the phrase is, hot er sich miyashiv given. He contemplated. He thought about it. He deliberated. He reflected. Hot er sich miyashiv given. That is, at every crucial moment of the story, what is required is the spiritual endurance to confront one's own weaknesses, that moment of radical self-confrontation. And when he does that, he actually addresses himself in the first person. Let's see, which way shall I go? What shall I do? So there is a speaking voice in the first person whom we hear. And that is the viceroy, in Yiddish, der Sheni le Malchus. Most of what he says to himself. He's the strong, silent type. Whenever he wakes up from his lengthy slumber, he says, "Wie bin ich in der Welt?" The person who has most of the speaking is the abducted princess. All the best dialogue is hers. In that recognition scene in the palace, it is she who speaks to him at length and says to him, "You cannot free me unless you choose a place and stay there for one whole year. During this entire year, you must yearn for me to free me from here. You will constantly yearn and search and hope to free me, and you will fast. And on that last day of the year, you shall fast and not sleep from sunset to sunrise." This is what the story is really about. When she comes upon him asleep on next to the highway, she laments the fact that he has failed yet again. She is the one who leaves him the message coded in her tears. So her speaking roles are actually much more significant than that of the viceroy, whose dialogue is mostly an internal dialogue. Finally, there are the giants. While the viceroy does a lot of crying, the giants repeat their phrase, "Es ist bavade nicht veranen, man hat dich eingerät an Narrigkeit." There is no such thing They just pull the wool over your eyes. The palace, castle you're looking for does not exist. So from the dialogue, we learn something very important, that the most proactive character is, in fact, not the viceroy, but the princess. And throughout the story, she's called the Bas Melech, not as one would expect in idiomatic Yiddish, the Bas Malke. She is literally the daughter of the king. She is not the princess, but the king's daughter. Through her active speaking role and through the name that Nachman has chosen for her, Nachman is signaling that the real story is happening on a different plane, on a mystical plane, and that the key to the story's meaning is Kabbalistic, is based on concepts in Lurianic Kabbalah. Why are there six sons and one daughter? Because this mimics the Sephirotic system, the emanations, the mystical emanations of God. Why is she called Bas Melech and not Bas Malke? Because she represents the lowest of these emanations, Malchut, the Shechina. She is the Shechina, the emanation of God, of the Godhead, that is closest to the physical universe. This is not a story about a banished princess, a daughter who is banished from the palace, but it is the Shechina who has been banished from God's presence. And that is why the struggle, the real struggle that takes place, is internal, is spiritual, is a story of longing, of yearning. And the final messianic achievement of that goal is deferred into the future. The story ends as follows. And how he freed her, Reb Nachman did not tell. And finally, he did free her. Und wie er hat sie herausgenommen, hat er nicht erzählt. Zum Sof hat er sie herausgenommen. Amen. Selah. So by changing the folk tale, the fairy tale, Reb Nachman wanted to restore the story to its original spiritual, mystical meaning. This is a quest of a spiritual seeker trying to redress a cosmic imbalance. And so doing, he, Reb Nachman, emerged as the first great Yiddish storyteller of all times.